is Wednesday, November 17. Thank you very much. Biochem 421. First slide of chapter 18. The stack of stuff back there is chapter 20. That's not an error. We'll eventually get to chapter 20. We're going to skip ahead to chapter 20 while I figure out what to do with chapter 18, because I'm having trouble. Well, at any rate, never mind. Okay, moving materials in and out of the mitochondrial membrane. Now, why do you have to have things move in and out of the mitochondrial membrane? The inner one? The inner one is the one that's impervious to everything. The outer one is the one that's got very, very, very lots of holes in it. Except there's one thing it won't allow out, and that's what? Hydrogen ion. That's exactly correct. We talked through that, and that, and that, and everything in the transporter, and finally, incomplete summary of transporters. So this is just a mere tithe of the kinds of proteins that are stuck on the inner mitochondrial membrane. A monocarboxylate transporter, pyruvate and hydroxide. Notice how the charge would be maintained. The dicarboxylate transporter, phosphate and malate are exchanged. Tricarboxylate, malate and citrate. Citrate's important there. You get a phosphate transporter, an adenine transporter, aspartate glutamate transporter, malate alpha-glutamate transporter. All this stuff to get stuff in and out. Sometimes it's carbons. Sometimes it's reducing units. Sometimes it's ATP. I mean, did you think about it? Have you really thought about it? Imagine how much ATP is made in the mitochondria. Because when you look at where it's made, it's all on the inner membrane. Okay? And we'll be looking at that today. But you got this ATPase, ATP synthase. A hydrogen ion comes back in. And you got the ADP being made into ATP. All right, well, that's all really well and good, except that's on the inside of the mitochondria, far, far away from where it's all going to be used. So you got to have a very active transport system to get that ATP out of the endocardial membrane and out of the, well, and then it goes smoothly through the outer membrane, and we're all set. So now, what are you going to have to know out of this? You will not need to know anything about that diagram. The purpose of that diagram is to illustrate the incredible number of transporters, proteins that the inner mitochondrial membrane makes up. You end up discovering some very important things. If you take Biochem 2, the lab at least, we're going to isolate mitochondria. Have you guys ever isolated mitochondria before? In what class? What was the source material? Cauliflower. You have isolated mitochondria from cauliflower. That's very nice. I isolate mitochondria from mouse liver. And so we sacrifice a couple of mice. But those mitochondria are easily pelleted in a centrifuge because they're so dense, little BBs. And they're BBs because of all the proteins there. And because many of the proteins have metal ions in them, electron transport system. Let's go ahead. All right, so note the following specific transporters. There's the monocarboxylate, pyruvate from glycolysis enters the mitochondria, the tricarboxylate, citrate for fat biosynthesis leaves mito, adenine nucleotide, that's ATP generated by ATP synthase leaves the mito, and below we're talking now about how the NADH enters the matrix of the mito by the malate aspartate shuttle, or the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. This is not in your text, ladies and gentlemen. This came from a text, a medical biochemistry text. So here's the malate aspartate shuttle. And if you look carefully, you got the cytosol right here and the mitochondria right here. And so what you're doing is you're trying to import the NADH from the glycolytic pathway production into the mitochondria where it can enter those electrons in the electron transport chain. And so here's where you start. You've got the NADH, you've got oxaloacetate that reduces it to make malate. Malate enters, and as it enters, it exchanges alpha-ketoglutarate. Okay? And therefore, it exchanges alpha-ketoglutarate. Now, this alpha-ketoglutarate, oddly enough, then... transfers an aspartate and glutamate. So this amine group. Let's see what happens to these nitrogens. Let's see. Transaminase, aspartate. This goes up here, and this comes back. Okay. So alpha-ketoglutarate, for reasons that are completely obscure to me, then gets an amine from aspartate and makes glutamate, and the aspartate makes oxaloacetate, which then is exchanged around. So it turns out that there's got to be two transporters going on in order to move that NADH into the mitochondria. This, again, is called the malate-aspartate shuttle. And the purpose of it is to move NADH from the cytosol into the mitochondria. Are you going to have to memorize this pathway? No. But what's the purpose of it? What's the malate aspartate shuttle? To move NADH reduction equivalents from the cytosol into the mitochondria. That's it. That's what I want you to know. And you can see here how it does it, but I'm not going to ask any questions about it. Another way of doing this is something known as the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. We're going to be looking at this in detail in the next page, but I just want to, while we're here, we're going to look at it. Here you have NADH being oxidized to NAD+. The dihydroxyacetone phosphate gets reduced and gets made in this alpha-glycerol phosphate. It then exchanges with the coenzyme protein here. It's a flavoprotein, and it oxidizes or reduces that coenzyme Q, which essentially is the equivalent of an FADH2. So what's being actually produced here is essentially an FADH2. Here you do lose reducing energy. So the top one you don't reduce, you do not lose reducing energy. The bottom one you do, the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle, the NADH gets made into an equivalent of FADH2 in order to get that in there. All right, so how do the reducing units of glycolysis get to mitochondria? That's the question you see there. Next question. Now, this is going to be a detail of what we just went through. The malate aspartate shuttle. NADH reduction produces malate from oxaloacetate by cytosolic, that's what the C is, cytosolic malate dehydrogenase. Malate and alpha-ketoglutarate are exchanged. Malate is oxidized to oxaloacetate by mitochondrial malate dehydrogenase. Oxaloacetate receives ammonia from glutamate and becomes aspartate. Glutamate donates ammonia to oxaloacetate and becomes that's actually not exactly correct. I'm going to have to correct that later. Just put a big question mark by that, and I'll come back to that. Glutamate, glutamic oxaloacetate transaminase, that's the enzyme that does this, but what's listed here is incorrect. Glutamate and aspartate exchange by transporter with the cytosolic compartment. 4 and 5 occur in a mirror image in the cytosol. So what's happening, you've got these exchanges of carbons and of nitrogens, and that's designed to keep the NADH units at a high level so you can transport NADH and don't lose any reducing units. And then the NADH shuttle begins again. I've got to double check that. That's got to be wrong. All right. If it's not wrong, then I've got to figure out why it's right. Form of NADH. This form of NADH shuttle does not lose reducing power. So basically circle this underline and circle that. And that's the two pieces of information that I'm going to ask you about. Circle the bottom thing here and the top thing. Just like I said before, the malate aspartate shuttle, this is an NADH shuttle that does not lose reducing power. That's the bottom line on that. Okay? We just don't have time if you have to memorize that shuttle in detail. Then you have the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. The reduction produces glycerol phosphate from DHAP. Put the DHAP in. The alpha-glycerate phosphate transfers reducing power to FADH2 coenzyme to form DHAP by mitochondrial alpha-glycerol phosphate dehydrogenase. Okay? The reducing power now exists as FADH2, and the FADH2 enters the electron transport system at coenzyme Q. This form of NADH shuttle does lose reducing power. So you circle this and circle the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. That's the two pieces of detail I'm going to ask you questions about. All right, next one. So here is the citrate malate shuttle. The citrate malate shuttle uses two enzymes, ATP citrate lyase and citrate synthase. Move citrate into the cytosol while fatty acid biosynthesis takes place. So it's lyase and synthase, so the two are on the first line. Move citrate into the cytosol where fatty acid biosynthesis takes place. So here you go, the cytosol, there's citrate in the cytosol. There's citrate in the mitochondria. Where does citrate come from, ladies and gentlemen? The combination of what? Acetyl-CoA and oxaloacetate. Well, oxaloacetate, of course, is a member of what cycle? Yes, and also citric acid cycle. Okay, now the gluconeogenesis is an absolutely correct answer, but that's occurring in the cytosol. Oh, well, it depends on the species. But it's primarily occurring in the cytosol. The stuff that's occurring in the mitochondria is the TCA cycle. So when we use this, when we do this, we move citric acid citrate into the cytosol, we begin to slow down the citric acid cycle. Let me ask you this question. True or false? As we move citrate into the cytosol for fatty acid biosynthesis, we begin to slow down the citric acid cycle. True or false? True is what one answer is. The only other answer is false. Fortunately enough for us, we're still alive, and so the answer is false, actually. Why? Where does that citrate actually come from that's being moved into the cytosol? Where's that coming from? Biosynthesis. Okay, so pyruvate. Where do you get pyruvate from, ladies and gentlemen? From the end of the glycolytic pathway. It gets transported to the mitochondria. If there's lots of excess of this, lots of pyruvate, you just got finished eating a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts. So there's lots of pyruvate in your liver. That goes into the mitochondria, where it gets acted upon by what enzyme? Pyruvate carboxylase. Pyruvate carboxylase then makes oxaloacetate. The oxaloacetate then gets made into a citric acid, citrate by what? Acetyl what? CoA and the enzyme that's listed there, which is a citrate what? Synthase, and then that gets moved out into the cytosol where fatty acid biosynthesis occurs. That's because fatty acid oxidation or breakdown occurs in which part, where? In the interior of the... So the fatty acid breakdown occurs in the mitochondria. Fatty acid oxidation occurs in the mitochondria. Synthesis occurs in the cytosol. Now, and just as kind of a trivial thing here, citrate is a precursor of fatty acid biosynthesis. Here's kind of a fun thing. Here's how you get ATP in and out. Let's see. Here's the cytosol. There's the mitochondria. There's ADP, which has got three negative charges. There's a transporter that moves it in, and there's an antiport that moves ATP out. Except there's a big problem with that. This is what charge on it? And what's the charge on the ATP? So there's a charge imbalance if that's all that was occurring. So there are other transporters that help modify the charge balance. They help modify the charge balance, ameliorate the charge balance. This is called a phosphate translocator, among other things. All right, that's it. Adenine dinucleotide transporter. Next, you like the swinging door aspect of it? Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. The thermodynamics of electron transport. Overview, NADH is highly reduced with a negative 0.315 voltage. What is water? Let's see here. Does it say this? Oxygen is highly oxidized with a positive 0.815 voltage value. Now, the difference between these two voltages is what keeps you alive, ladies and gentlemen. Which keeps you alive. That's the very essence of ATP production in your body, is the difference in the oxidation reduction potential of those two compounds. Right here. And it is the marvelousness of photosynthesis that plants can accumulate enough energy from photon strikes to remove this hydrogen and electrons from the oxygen and release it. They oxidize oxygen, ladies and gentlemen. Amazing. All right, well, anyway. So here you got the highly reduced, here the highly oxidized. The difference between the two is the energy they extract out in terms of life, in terms of captured in ATP. Difference between these two compounds, probably the energy for us to live. Details. The four complexes. 1 to 4. Energy extracted from electrons only at 1, 3, and 4. This is illustrated here by formation of ATP. This is a dangerous illustration, ladies and gentlemen, because it appears like the ATP is actually being generated at each complex. Doesn't it? Yeah. It isn't, is it? What's actually happening in each complex, according to the chemiosmotic theory? Proton pumping. So do yourself a favor, perhaps, and over here maybe write, maybe write inner mitochondrial matrix, and out here write intermembrane region, matrix, intermembrane region, matrix, intermembrane region, and then draw an arrow through the complex with a hydrogen ion here, pointing, moving toward the intermembrane region. So it should look something like this. This is the matrix. All right. Over here is the intermembrane region. Membrane region. Here you got the first box. You got a proton here. You've got an arrow pointing through there. It pumps it over here. That's what happens at each of those times as they pass through those complexes. So complex 1 pumps protons. Complex 3 pumps protons. Complex 4 pumps protons. But they show the production of ATP here. This is not entirely 100% efficient, although it's really, really close. It appears then, if NADH comes in and dumps its electrons on complex 1, as you pass through these various complexes, each pair of electrons that are coming from NADH should produce 1, 2, 3 ATP. Does that make sense? That's where we get this ATP, this P-O ratio, P to O ratio. And we're going to discuss that, or at least mention it again at the end. P to O ratio, if we go by that diagram, looks like 3. The book, however, based on the most current research, says the PO to ratio is actually closer to 2.5. You'll see some of my equations or calculations are based on 3. In the book, they're going to be based on 2.5. All right. So this pumps the equivalent of enough protons to produce an ATP. To produce an equivalent of another ATP, so you get 3 for NADH. Why do you only get 2 with FADH2? That's right. It's got a lower reduction potential. Therefore, it enters not at complex 1, but at complex 2, which does not pump. Complex 2 does not pump. Simply an acceptor of FADH2 goes through complex 3 and 4 instead of 1, 3, and 4, and therefore produces only 2. ATP is not synthesized in complexes, only its energy equivalent. Complex 1, 3, and 4 have the free energy available to power ATP formation. Complex 2 accepts reducing power from FADH2, which is less reduced than NADH. Complex 4 is the site where electrons of NADH and FADH combine with hydrogen ion and oxygen to form water. Complex 1 is inhibited by rotenone, which is a rat poison, or amytol. Complex 3 is inhibited by antimyosin A, And complex 4 is inhibited by cyanide. I do want you to know what each of those complexes are inhibited by. Please recall which one of those, the specific compound that, in fact, inhibits each one of those. Complex 4 is cyanide. Complex 3 is antimyosin A. Complex 1 is rotenone or amytal. Now you see in part why cyanide poisoning is so dangerous. Because what complex does it inhibit? Now then, do you want any of these electron transport, any of these ETS complexes inhibited? No, maybe regulated, but certainly not inhibited. There are lots of symptoms to cyanide poisoning, and it does accumulate. I mean, it's not like one molecule is going to kill you, but if you get enough cyanide, it will inhibit enough of this, and you're sick as a dog, and then you're dead. Okay, and lastly, complex 1, 4, and 1, 3, and 4 appear to pump protons with their available free energy. I think that appear is actually I'm being a little disingenuous. It's pretty much proven it does pump. So here NADH dumps its two electrons. Protons are pumped through complex 1, pass through coenzyme Q, go on to complex 3 where they're pumped through cytochrome C through complex 4. So you got a pump here, and a pump here. And eventually those electrons are dumped onto what? Oxygen to make what? Now what happens if you're exercising vigorously and you exceed your oxygen carrying capacity? What happens here? Are the electrons going to be able to be dumped on oxygen that's not there? Huh? Are the electrons going to be dumped on oxygen that's not there? What's the obvious answer? No. So what happens to these electrons? They start building up, don't they? They build up here, they build up here, they build up here. If they build up here, NADH cannot be dumped onto them. Is that correct? That means you begin to accumulate NADH. If you accumulate NADH, what material begins to have a lower concentration? NAD plus concentration drops because all the electrons are bound up in the NADH. NAD plus drops. What's that doing to glycolysis, ladies and gentlemen? Slowing it down. Do you want to slow down glycolysis during vigorous exercise? No. Do you want to stop glycolysis ever? No, because you are dead then. Okay? Boom. You just keel over, standing upright. So, what does the glycolysis do? What does the body do to attempt to make enough NAD plus to survive, to make sure glycolysis continues if there's not enough oxygen here to allow the NADH to dump its electrons on there? What does it make? Lactic acid. Is that correct? Say yes. If you're a yeast, what does it do? Makes alcohol. If you don't have any oxygen. Okay? My understanding is, and I'm no connoisseur, but if you actually use a gas-proof plug in the bottle, you make champagne. Because the carbon dioxide can't escape, and therefore it's in the liquid. But if you have a cork, which allows the carbon dioxide to escape, then you end up making wine. That's how I understand it, at least. All right, now here's what's actually happening, ladies and gentlemen. Coupling electron transport and ATP synthesis. Chi-me osmotic theory. Complex 1 accepts electrons from NADH, not shown. You could draw a line here that has NADH going to NAD+, if you'd like. Electrons from FADH2 enter complex 3. So it's right in here. NADH enters right around in between 1 and 2, as you know. Hydrogen ion concentration builds up in the intermembrane region. Hydrogen ion can't escape because the outer and inner membranes are impermeable to hydrogen ion. Complex 4, which is shown here, uses free energy electron chemical gradient formed by the hydrogen ion pumps to synthesize ATP from ADP. Now, this particular text has a nice section on the ATP synthase. It would behoove you to read it. It would behoove you to read it. Now, yes, it would behoove you to read it because you're going to be. You're probably going to get some take-home questions about it on Friday because you're getting on Friday. You're getting a take-home quiz. Yes. Complex 2 is not shown here because all this shows is the pumping ones. Yep. Good question, just not there. Okay, so this builds up in a high concentration, and then the free energy movement from high concentration to low concentration is the energy necessary for the ATP synthase, which is a marvelously complex machine. Again, a miracle of biochemical engineering. One that occurred apparently completely by accident. Wow. Isn't nature smart? Oh, I'm sorry. Nature has no intelligence. So how could it design anything? I don't know. You see these guys? Oh, never mind. All right. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, how in the world do you know this occurs? The chemiosmotic theory. Prove it, you say. And I say, okay, I've found a nice diagram that helps prove it. And this is a fascinating series of experiments that includes some important concepts about how they determine it. So I've given you an entire page of this. If you want it blown up, you'll have to download it and make it big, because it should blow up very nicely. I'm going to read this, because it's that important. I'm going to ask questions about it on the next test, especially lots of what-if questions. What if I don't do this? What if I do something else? What if I add it in a different order? What's the diagram going to look like? Here you go. The rate of respiration. Now, what's the word respiration mean? Rate of respiration. It's another way of saying the rate of oxygen consumption. The rate of oxygen consumption. Respiration. You're not respiring to get nitrogen. You're not respiring to get water vapor. You're respiring to get oxygen and expel. In this case, we're talking about oxygen consumption. By a suspension of mitochondria, it can be increased dramatically by the addition of small amounts of ADP. Really? An oxidizable substrate, in this case, succinate. Where would succinate? Why would you use succinate as an oxidizable intermediate? Citric acid cycle, but can you get reducing units from succinate? Yes, GTP, but that's not reducing units. Do you make an FAD after succinate? Do you make an FAD after succinate? Yes, you do. So this succinate is there to make FADH2, which is a reduced compound, which is it helps the electron transport system. An inorganic phosphate. So a small amount of ADP and inorganic phosphate. I bet those two will make ATP, but they don't measure ATP. Are added at times indicated by vertical arrows, but the respiratory rate remains low until ADP is added. So here's the oxygen concentration. That's measure of respiration. Here's the time in minutes. You've got what suspended in a test tube? What do you have suspended in a test tube, ladies and gentlemen? You got a big old test tube. Boom, boom. Exactly right. You got mito suspended there. Is that correct? You've got a glass probe here that's measuring oxygen concentration. What else do you have in there? You got succinate. What's that going to provide? Well, it'll provide a source for FADH2 for the electron transport system. That's it. With mitochondria and succinate, are you going to have, with just mitochondria and succinate, are you going to have a lot of oxygen consumption? The answer to that is no. Why not? Because while you're making lots of FADH2, those electrons are going along and pump those protons and theoretically should be making oxygen except for the fact that there's no ADP there. Why would no ADP reduce the amount of oxygen consumption? Why would no ADP present reduce or eliminate the amount of oxygen consumed? Correct. Without ADP, can you make ATP? Say no. Without making ATP, is hydrogen ion allowed through? No. Without hydrogen ion being allowed through, does hydrogen ion build up here? Yes. With hydrogen ion build up here, are you going to have a rapid reduction of oxygen? Say no. So the lack of ADP prevents oxygen from being consumed. Do you understand that idea, ladies and gentlemen? Okay, let's go on to the next. Let's try this. Now then, so they put PI in there. They put inorganic phosphate, right? They added inorganic phosphate right there. Why didn't the oxygen concentration, why didn't the consumption start right there? Because there's still no what in there? No what? ADP. So they add a small amount of ADP, and suddenly you've got succinate, inorganic phosphate, ADP, and oxygen consumption drops, uses up very quickly. What's happening? Well, they put a small amount of ADP in there, in inorganic phosphate. That allows the what? ATP to be made, which allows what? Hydrogen to pass through, which allows the what? Concentration to decrease a little bit, which allows the what? Protons to pump, which allows the electrons to pass through, land on the oxygen, get made into water, and the oxygen concentration decreases. Are you following me here? Okay. This is a very, very important idea about critical thinking, ladies and gentlemen. This is what you're going to be doing as physicians and dentists and grad students and high school teachers. Okay? Putting all these different pieces together. Now, they apparently add plenty of phosphate and plenty of succinate, but didn't add enough ADP. So they add another dose of ADP, and you get, boom, a little more oxygen used up. And it flattens out again as the ATP is used up. So right in there, there's no ADP left over from the previous addition. Right here, there's no ADP left over from the previous addition. All right, so you got the model. A second period of rapid respiration or rapid oxygen consumption is obtained when more ADP is added, indicating that essentially all the ADP gets used up. The P2O ratio can be determined by dividing the amount of ADP added by the amount of oxygen taken up, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's where the P2O ratio comes in. Now, that was this diagram. Here's A, here's B. A, addition of an uncoupler to a suspension of mitochondria causes brisk O2 consumption, which continues until all the oxygen in the solution is used up. An oxidizable substrate, succinate, is added before the uncoupler, but PI is not required. Okay? An uncoupler. An uncoupler, in this case, punches a hole in the inner membrane region and allows hydrogen ion to rapidly and unencumberedly pass through without any ATP production. So here's the inner, here's the outer, here's complex one, there's two, here's three, here's four, here's five, boom, boom, zoom. Under normal circumstances, a high concentration of hydrogen, is that correct? They add an uncoupler, and literally, it punches a hole through this membrane, and hydrogen ion rapidly passes through. It does not make ATP. It simply allows the hydrogen ion to pass through. Now, why would there be a rapid and unstoppable oxygen consumption when you punch a hole in the intermembrane region with this uncoupler? I'm sorry, what? Chemical balance, all right. That's absolutely true. Now, what happens here at 4? What happens at 4? Electrons get dumped onto what? Oxygen to make what? Water. Prior to this, with the oxygen consumption, was there any oxygen consumption? No. Prior to adding the uncoupler, was there any oxygen consumption? No. It was a relatively straight line. So you put the uncoupler in, the hydrogen ion concentration here rapidly drops. Is that correct? Right. So if it rapidly drops, what happens then? This is incorrect. It actually is back here. Well, protons are free to pump. Is that correct? Protons are free to pump. It's almost like a freewheeling, unencumbered pumping of hydrogen ions. Now, if that's the case, are you going to rapidly use up your oxygen as the electrons pass through? Yes. Are you making any ATP here? No. That's with an uncoupler. So you get that straight drop of oxygen, a direct linear oxygen consumption, because with this hole, everything works except, everything is operating at full speed except the ATP synthase, which is unneeded now because the hydrogen ions can rapidly and unencumberedly move from the intermembrane into the matrix. And so you have a huge, rapid, linear oxygen concentration consumption. Now notice what happens with number letter B. All right, oligomycin. Oligomycin. Where have you seen oligomycin before? Oligomycin. Oh, well, it doesn't show it there, but I guess oligomycin is an inhibitor of complex. Does it say what complex it is? I'm going to have to go through this. Dink, 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 dink. Inhibitor of the ATP synthase. So, the oligomycin attacks what? Not complex 1, not complex 3, not complex 4, but oligomycin blocks the ATP synthase. Oligomycin, whatever. Inhibitor blocks the stimulation of respiration caused by ATP. It does not block the stimulation caused by an uncoupler. So, here you go. You add succinate. You add phosphate. You add oligomycin. You add ADP. Why isn't there a drop of oxygen consumption when you add ADP there? It did here. What? Correct. The ADP that's sitting right here that you just added can't move. Because this is blocked. Are there any if this is blocked, are there any hydrogen ions passing through? No. If there's no hydrogen ions passing through, are you going to be consuming oxygen? No. And therefore, you don't get any oxygen consumption right here because the ATP synthase is blocked. Why if you add the oxygen, what if you add the uncoupler is that sudden rapid drop? Because you, what? Correct. You've bypassed the blocked ATP synthase. You punched a hole in the intermembrane. The hydrogen ions can pass through unencumbered and rapidly consume oxygen as the electrons are pumped. Or hydrogen ions are pumped. Does this make sense, ladies and gentlemen? This, yes? Oligomycin? Oligomycin? Oligomycin. Well, it's an antibiotic. So it's produced probably by some fungus or whatever. I've never heard it used in humans, probably because it acts on mitochondria. I mean, do you want anything acting on your mitochondria? I don't think so. All right, control of ATP reduction, ladies and gentlemen. Noted in the text, an average adult woman requires about 1,500 kilocalories a day. This is equivalent to free energy of greater than 200 moles of ATP. The ADP per day, yet her entire body contains less than 1/10 of a mole of ATP. So here, at any given instant, you have less than 1/10 of a mole of ATP, and yet you use it over and over and over again. So how is ATP synthesis so exquisitely controlled for immediate need but never stored? Exquisite for immediate need but never stored. Well, it's not never stored. There's actually one small molecule that your muscles contain for immediate need for ATP. That's creatine. Creatine phosphate is an ATP buffer that you find in your is it creatine? I think it's creatine. Yeah, creatine phosphate. All right. At any rate, I'm getting mixed up with something else. So, multiple materials. The following materials stimulate the glucose flux. High levels of inorganic phosphate, AMP, ammonium, iron, ADP, fructose-6-phosphate, calcium, high ratio of coash to succinyl-CoA. Conversely, the following materials reduce glucose flux during ATP production. High levels of glucose 6, high levels of ATP, high levels of citrate, high ratio of NADH to NAD+. Now, let's take a look at this bottom one. Does that make sense that that would reduce glucose flux? If you have lots of glucose 6-phosphate, that probably means there's plenty of energy being made or you're breaking down glycogen. High levels of ATP, well, of course, your energy replete. High levels of citrate, that means you're probably getting ready to make fat. So who needs more energy if you're already making fat? High ratios of NADH to NAD+. That means if you have high levels of NADH relative to NAD+, you probably are still energy, plenty of energy repleteness. Probably a lot of energy. Now, so you look here at glucose 6 phosphofructokinase. What the two things here I want you to know, there's three. There's four, no, eight, 12, 127, no, at any rate. There's three. Are you ready? The regulation of phosphofructokinase. What turns it on? What turns it off? The regulation of pyruvate dehydrogenase. What turns it on and turns it off? And then for the citric acid cycle, I want you to know the only thing there that I want you to know is that high ratio or high levels of NADH slow down the citric acid cycle. That's it. So citric acid cycle, NADH at high levels slow it down. Pyruvate dehydrogenase, those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things. Phosphofructokinase, those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things. There's a feed-forward activation. Inorganic phosphate turns it on. AMP turns it on. Ammonium turns it on. ATP, of course, naturally turns it off. It's turned off before it gets turned on. There's a feedback stimulation. Look at that. Phosphofructose 1,6, and there's citrate turns it off. What? Huh? Three of them. Phosphofructokinase. Pyruvate kinase. No, pyruvate dehydrogenase. Pyruvate dehydrogenase. And then just in general, the citric acid cycle and NADH. Yes? Would insulin raise the citrate? Yes, insulin would raise the citrate cycle a little. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, yeah. To be honest, I mean, let me speak frankly. Insulin, while it's extraordinarily important and has a wide variety of effects, those effects are still being determined even today. And it can apparently have contradictory effects in the same cell. So I am not an insulin researcher. I can give you a broad general idea of what insulin does, but I am not prepared to really discuss insulin in detail, especially at that level of regulation. Because it can apparently have contradictory effects that you would not suspect it would have. Because of its exquisite regulation of both fatty acid metabolism, carbohydrate metabolism, and protein metabolism. It regulates all of those. And you can apparently it looks like you're turning on a carbohydrate metabolism when in fact that's being turned on to make amino acids. So you have to be, yeah. Probably in dental school, medical school, they'll talk about it in detail. I'm just not prepared to talk about the details of insulin. Sorry. All right, let's go ahead. P2O ratio is, okay, so again, ATP synthesis coupled to proton gradient. Not an integral number. Pumping is not always efficient. There's proton leakage. The book says about 2.5. Of course, some of my calculations you'll see in the future use 3. That's okay. And then this. Now, what are we going to do since we are going to be whacking? I mean, we're really going at this hammer and tongs because we're getting through a lot. What I'm going to do is, now this is starting with, this is number 18, is that correct? Okay. No. I think what I'm going to do is, next Friday, actually. while you're standing in line at Best Buy to buy that 55-inch LED big screen TV for $250. Yeah. I'll hand out a quiz there. I think starting with 18, I'm going to make them all take home. Okay, I'm going to pass them out in class, right? Just for practice. We don't have time, and poor Dana is just overwhelmed with other stuff near the end of the semester. So starting with 18, I'll give this to you take home. Okay? And I'll pass that out probably Friday when everybody's back from the back T test. I'm going to hand that out as well. This will be due after Thanksgiving, the Monday after Thanksgiving. Everything's going to be due the Monday after Thanksgiving. Okay. Now then. You now have in your hand, ladies and gentlemen, the start of chapter 20, which is lipid metabolism. Under normal circumstances, now where are you guys going? Nobody's going anywhere. We got 3 minutes, full value for your tuition dollar. I just hear a lot of noise. Now, I've given this to you. Is that correct? You have it? Okay. It should be back there somewhere. And so, under normal circumstances, and I would have brought a bag of Oreos. And I may still do that on Friday. And give everybody an Oreo and then have them eat the fatty white thing in the middle. And then we get to talk about lipid metabolism. Okay, let's go, ladies and gentlemen. Lipid metabolism, digestion, absorption of dietary lipids. What you're going to see on this first page is not in your text. So pay attention to this. You're not going to see it anywhere else. And I got 1 minute. Digestive dietary lipid begins in the stomach by an acid-stable lipase secreted in the back of the tongue. Did you know that? There's an acid-stable lipase that's actually secreted. Small amounts in the back of the tongue, lands in your stomach, survives there, and begins to act on the fat that you're eating. Complete digestion, absorption of lipids takes place primarily in the lumen of the small intestine. You need to digest this. This is in lumen. You need bile acids, also known as bile salts. What is the structural building block for bile salts, bile acids? Cholesterol. Bile acids are salts. They're built from cholesterol. It's a steroidal backbone. You need an enzyme called a lipase. You need another protein called a colipase that exists in a one-to-one ratio with lipase. Why do you need that? Because lipase is a protein that's basically like you're trying to kiss a porcupine. How do you kiss a porcupine? Very carefully. Why is that? Okay, here you got this water, you got this oil droplet, oil. You got this protein that's supposed to embed in that to free up fatty acids. The only problem with that protein, of course, is it's water soluble, which means the inner part of that protein is what? Hydrophobic. But it's interfacing with an oil droplet. It should naturally do what? Unfold. So this oil droplet has a tendency to try to force that protein to unfold because the hydrophobic interior. You get a stabilizing protein next to it called colipase that helps stabilize that lipase so it can survive that environment that's part oil and part water. Yes? This protein exists in the lumen of the intestinal tract. That's primarily water.
Okay, so that side of it is water soluble,
and the other side is water soluble? Yes. Well, I mean, the details of the exact nature of the colipase I'm not familiar with. I do know that it embeds itself into the oil droplet. It has to in order to release the fatty acids. So part of it is water, is oil lovable, But this oil droplet eventually is consumed, and this thing is simply floating free until it finds another oil droplet. So it has to be water soluble. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you each of you tomorrow. I will definitely record this lecture tomorrow for those of you in back tea.
Thank you.